Welcome to Blog Talk Radio. This is Westchester on the Level with your host, Hezzy Eris.
Good morning, everybody. Well, today is Wednesday. It's May 13th, and it's 10 o'clock on the Eastern Seaboard. The first hour today will just be you and I, and then at 11 o'clock, we're going to speak to a gentleman by the name of Brian Hoadley. He's a Power Breezer's Chief Revenue Officer, and he's going to immerse us in the technology that has begotten a remedy necessary for our time, specifically with regard to the coronavirus. And so we'll see how he uses that technology and the efficacy of it, which has not been used beyond the means that they've already begun using it. And so we're going to have a lot to discuss. And we're going to cover a lot of international news and things that relate to us, but we're going to start off with what's happening here in the United States. Evidently, Trump aide Kushner is suggesting a delay is possible in the United States elections. Well, President Donald Trump's aide and son-in-law, Jared Kushner, said he couldn't guarantee the United States presidential election will take place on time. He says due to the coronavirus pandemic, only to walk back his comment. The election is scheduled for November 3rd by law, and the White House has no authority to make a change. However, Kushner's remark on Tuesday touched a nerve as Trump and Democratic rival Joe Biden head into the increasingly tense final 6 months of campaigning. Asked in an interview by Time magazine whether he could commit to the election being on schedule, even if a second coronavirus wave breaks out, Kushner said, quote, I'm not sure I can commit one way or the other, but right now that's the plan, end quote. And then continuing, he says, hopefully by the time we get to September, October, November, we've done enough work with testing and with all the different things we're trying to do to prevent a future outbreak of the magnitude that would make us shut down again, said Kushner, whose title is senior advisor. Although Kushner did not say he wanted a change in date and noted, quote, it's not my decision to make, end quote, his remarks were attacked by Trump critics as evidence of overreach. And shortly after, to NBC News saying, quote, I have not been involved in, nor am I aware of, any discussions about trying to change the date of the presidential election, end quote. The election date is under scrutiny, given the massive logistical disruption caused by coronavirus lockdowns and the risk that voters will stay away from the crowded polling stations. However, both Trump and Biden have said they see no change in date happening. In most polls, Biden is leading Trump, whose first term has been marred by impeachment, a two-year probe into his links with Russia, and unprecedented political partisanship across the country. Kushner, a wealthy real estate owner, is married to his daughter, Ivanka, who is also a White House presidential advisor. Well, let's look at some other issues that matter to us here. And let's look at what's going on with the United States Supreme Court. Evidently, it appears that the court is divided in a debate over Trump's taxes that we spoke to you about yesterday. President Donald Trump's claim of a near absolute right to keep his finances secret rose to the Supreme Court on Tuesday, the culmination of a years-long showdown over the balance of power in the United States government. The president has not released his tax returns despite promising during the 2016 election to do so, bucking a voluntary tradition upheld by every United States leader since Richard Nixon in the 1970s. His finances are the target of congressional investigations by Democrats looking into the president, the Trump Organization, and his family in what started as a probe into foreign influence in 2016. Meanwhile, New York prosecutor Cyrus Vance, a Democrat, is looking into whether Trump broke the law over hush money payments to a porn star and a former Playboy model who say they slept with Trump. Observers say the court's decision over whether to compel the release of his finances could have profound long-term implications for lawmakers' ability to scrutinize presidents. Trump's lawyers have argued in lower courts that he enjoys complete immunity while in office. But liberal justice Elena Kagan told the president's legal team it was a, quote, fundamental precept of our constitutional order that the president is not above the law, end quote. The president's defenders say the investigations are politically driven and amount to harassment, interfering in his ability to lead. Quote, it is no secret that the relationship between the House of Representatives and the president is frayed, but this is not the first nor the last time that one House of Congress will be at odds with the president, said Trump attorney Patrick Strawbridge. Quote, the rule the court applies here will affect not only this president, but the presidency itself, he warned. Well, presidents are not required by law to release details of their private finances. But the nine justices, two picked by Trump, three by previous Republican presidents, and four by Democrats, acknowledged that the president had bucked tradition. Quote, we have never had to address this issue, and the reason is because Congress and the president have reached accommodations with each other, Kagan, one of the court's liberals, told Strawbridge. What you are asking us to do is to put a kind of 10-ton weight on the scales between the president and the Congress, she said. Trump's secrecy over his tax returns has prompted speculation over the former real estate magnate's true worth and his possible financial entanglements. Congressional investigations have raised questions about whether he has sensitive financial exposure to Russia and also whether he has used questionable accounting loopholes to avoid paying taxes in the 1990s and 2000s. In both the New York and congressional cases, subpoenas were issued to Mazars, I don't know how to pronounce it, that's Trump's longtime accounting firm, as well as to Deutsche Bank and Capital One Bank, demanding his financial records for 2011 to 2018. The Supreme Court heard repeated references to the Watergate scandal of the early 1970s, in which Nixon refused to comply with a congressional immunity claim when Paula Jones sued him in the 1990s for sexual harassment. In both cases, the court ruled against absolute immunity for the president. And Trump's lawyers argue that neither ruling applied, saying the congressional and New York subpoenas demonstrated no clear need for the president's financial records. And these subpoenas fail every hallmark of a legitimate congressional investigation, Strawbridge had said. He added they impinged on Trump's ability to carry out the duties of his office. Unlike Congress, the president is never in recess, he quipped. But the lawyer for Congress, Douglas Letter, argued there was a clear need for the documents. Quote, there is an obvious need to focus on the president's financial record to determine if the president is subject to foreign leverage, and it's obvious that ties with a legislative purpose, Letter had said. You also said the case before the Supreme Court was very specific and did not require a decision that would shift the balance of power in governance. Very, very compelling, to say the least. So bear with me a moment here. I want to go through some of these other concerns. Well, let's look at what the president is doing with Pompeo. Evidently, Pompeo is visiting Israel for talks on plans to annex parts of the West Bank. The U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo arrived in Israel on Wednesday for talks on regional security and the country's plans to annex parts of the occupied West Bank. Pompeo was to meet Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and incoming Defense Minister Benny Gantz a day before a unity government agreed between the two men is due to be sworn in. The talks were also expected to cover common arch foe Iran. Israel is believed to have launched strikes against Iranian bases in neighboring Syria in recent weeks and the Jewish state's trade relations with China. Pompeo wore a red, white, and blue protective face mask when he landed at Ben Gurion Airport near Tel Aviv for his first trip abroad in nearly 2 months amid the COVID-19 pandemic. in what the United States Embassy in Jerusalem called a cautionary measure. Pompeo will not meet Ambassador David Friedman, who was said by an embassy spokesman to be displaying, quote, mild upper respiratory symptoms, although he had tested negative for the novel coronavirus. The visit came as violence broke out in the occupied West Bank. Israeli forces shot down a Palestinian teenager during clashes in the West Bank on Wednesday, the Palestinian Health Ministry had said. The ministry announced that Zaid Haisia, 15, was, quote, killed by a live bullet in the head fired by an Israeli soldier in Al-Fawar camp near Hebron in the southern West Bank, with a further four Palestinians injured during clashes. Now, the Israeli army said it was checking the reports. An Israeli soldier was killed early on Tuesday during a West Bank arrest raid when a rock thrown off a rooftop struck him in the head, the military had said. The military said the 21-year-old Staff Sergeant Amit Ben Yigal was on routine operational duty or activity near the West Bank city of Jenin when a large rock was thrown off a rooftop and struck him on the head. A search was on for the attacker. Netanyahu and Gantz faced off in three inconclusive elections in less than a year before agreeing to a three-year power-sharing administration. Netanyahu, the right-winger in power since 2009, will serve as prime minister for 18 months with Gantz, a former army chief, as his alternate after the latter resigned as parliamentary speaker on Tuesday in preparation for his new role. The two will swap posts midway through the deal. Now, their coalition agreement says that the Israeli government can, from July 1st, begin considering implementing the West Bank annexation detailed in President Donald Trump's Middle East peace plan. Unveiled in January, the controversial plan gives a green light from Washington for Israel to annex Jewish settlements and other strategic West Bank territory. Palestinians have rejected Trump's plan and cut ties with the Trump administration in 2017 over its pro-Israel stance. Their chief negotiator, Saeb Erekat, said that Pompeo's team had not reached out ahead of the visit. The Trump administration is collaborating with Israel in its annexation plan in what is both an attempt at burying the rights of the Palestinian people as well as a blatant attack on the rules-based international system, he said. Israel has controlled the West Bank since seizing it in the Six-Day War back in 1967. And nearly 3 million Palestinians live there, alongside more than 400,000 Israelis residing in settlements that are considered illegal under international law. For the Palestinians and much of the international community, Israeli annexation would sink any hope of a two-state solution to the conflict. In an interview ahead of his visit with the newspaper Israel Hayom, Pompeo said that whether and how to go ahead with annexation was, quote, a decision Israel will make, end quote. And continuing, he said, I want to understand what the new government thinks about it, Pompeo reportedly said, noting that Trump's initiative was unveiled several months before the Netanyahu-Gantz deal. The United States plan recognizes Jerusalem as Israel's undivided capital, defined Palestinian aspirations that the eastern part of the city will serve as their future capital. Former U.S. President Barack Obama's ambassador to Israel, Daniel Shapiro, told Agent France Press that he believed Pompeo was being disingenuous, quote-unquote, in claiming annexation decisions would be left to Israel. I think the Trump administration very much wants this annexation to happen, said Shapiro, a visiting fellow at Tel Aviv University's Institute for National Security Studies. Quote, it is probably less concerned about the specific boundaries, but it wants to have an achievement in Israeli annexation that it can tout to President Trump's evangelical supporters and right-wing Jewish supporters to excite them and energize them ahead of the United States elections in November, Shapiro had said. Netanyahu may be tempted to move quickly in order to help Trump in that vote and to ensure annexation is a done deal before a possible unfavorable change in the at the helm of the White House, Shapiro had added. But that would create substantial risks internationally and could cause deep division within Netanyahu's coalition, the former ambassador added. Previous coalition had hardline pro-annexation right-wingers in key posts, notably outgoing Defense Minister Naftali Bennett. And Gantz has praised the Trump plan, but warned against moves that threaten regional stability. Experts have said that Jordan might back away from the historic 1994 peace deal with the Jewish state if Israel annexes the Jordan Valley, a strategically crucial border region that accounts for roughly 30% of the West Bank. So, very, very compelling stuff, as they say. Now, let's look at some other stuff that's going on around the world. Let's look at what's going on in Russia. Evidently, Russia has recorded more than, are you sitting down for this, 10,000 new virus cases. It seems that Russia reported more than 10,000 new coronavirus cases today, continuing a grim trend that has seen the country register the world's second highest number of infections. Health officials reported 10,028 new cases over the last 24 hours, bringing Russia's total number of infections to 242,271. Health Minister Mikhail Murashko told Parliament more than 100,000 patients are now hospitalized with confirmed or suspected coronavirus, a significant jump from the figure of 80,000 he gave on Friday. Nearly 1,500 patients are currently on ventilators, the minister said. Six patients have died in deadly fires at hospitals in Moscow and St. Petersburg over the last week. And the blazes have been linked to domestically produced ventilators, and the country's healthcare regulator on Wednesday suspended the use of the particular model involved. Murashko acknowledged outgoing disruptions, quote-unquote, in supplies of personal protective equipment for medics, while he said those working in red zones with infected patients now have enough. The Kremlin this week began easing a national lockdown to slow the spread of the virus, despite a steady rise in numbers that on Tuesday brought Russia to second place in a global tally of infections behind the United States. A majority of Russia's new cases were registered in the capital, a government virus tally said, where Moscow Mayor Sergei Sobyanin has down until the end of May. Well, President Vladimir Putin's spokesman Dmitry Peskov has become the most recent senior official to test positive for the coronavirus. He told reporters he was receiving treatment in hospital. His wife, Olympic dancer Tatiana Navka, who has also tested positive, wrote on Instagram that she was already recovering, but, quote, it's a bit more complicated for my husband. Despite the steady rise in new cases, Russia reported mortality rate is significantly lower compared to other European countries hit hard by the pandemic, with 96 new deaths and a total of 2,212 dead from the coronavirus as of Wednesday. Authorities say the low mortality rate is because Russia was able to learn lessons from the experiences of Western Europe, moving quickly to isolate travelers and people at risk, convert hospitals for virus patients, and launch a vast campaign to test and quarantine those infected. Health Minister Murashko said that low fatalities were thanks to our hero medics, end quote. Authorities on Monday said they had carried out nearly 6 million tests, but critics have cast doubt on the figures, accusing the authorities of undercounting by blaming virus-related deaths on other causes. Murashko said that Russia was working on developing vaccines and clinical tests as planned to start and planned to start in June. So we'll have to see where all that goes. More stuff on international concerns. Evidently, China is warning France against selling weapons to Taiwan. Well, China warned France on Wednesday that to, quote, Sino-French relations, end quote, by selling arms to neighboring Taiwan, which is planning to buy weapons as part of an upgrade to a French-made warship fleet bought 30 years ago. China says that Taiwan is part of one China and that this principle must be accepted by any country with which it has diplomatic relations. Arms sales to Taiwan are always highly sensitive and regularly prompt a strong reaction from Beijing. Taiwan is mostly equipped with U.S.-made weapons, but in 1991, France sold Taiwan six Lafayette frigates to China's anger. And France also sold Taiwan 60 Mirage Q-92. Since then, China has vastly expanded its economic and military capabilities and has grown more assertive in its efforts to thwart such sales. Taiwan last month said it was seeking to buy equipment from France to upgrade the ship's missile interference system. Speaking in Beijing, Chinese Foreign Minister spokesman Zhao Lijian said that China resolutely opposed any arms sales to Taiwan. Quote, "We have already expressed our serious concern to France," he told a daily news briefing. "We again urge the French side to abide by the One China principle and withdraw the arms sale plan to Taiwan to avoid harming Sino-French relations," the spokesman had added. And France has rejected Chinese criticism of the planned weapons sale with Taiwan, saying that everyone's focus at this time should be on fighting the coronavirus epidemic. France strictly respects the contractual agreement that it formed with Taiwan, and nothing has changed in its position since 1994, the French Foreign Ministry said in a statement on Wednesday, referring to a 1994 agreement re-establishing ties with Beijing. "Faced with the COVID-19 crisis, all our attention and all our efforts should be focused on the fight against the pandemic," the ministry added. Taiwan says it needs to upgrade its armed forces to deal with the growing threat from China, which has in recent months stepped up its military drills near the democratic self-governing island. China describes Taiwan as its most sensitive and important territorial issue and has never renounced the use of force to bring the island under its control. Taiwan has shown no interest in being ruled by autocratic China. So, very, very compelling stuff. Now, let's move on to what's going on in the international framework, and this will just drive you insane. The non-governmental organization is reporting details of the Islamic State group's abyss of horror in northern Syria. Human Rights Watch released details of a mass grave in Al-Huta Gorge in northern Syria. In a report published on May 4, the non-governmental organization, the NGO, said that the so-called Islamic State group was responsible and called for further investigation into this pit of death. Researchers call it the Abyss of Horror. Located 85 kilometers north of Raqqa, the former capital of Islamic State in Syria, which was used as a mass grave by the jihadist groups, the group that ruled the region from 2013 to 2015, Human Rights Watch revealed. The NGO investigated the matter from 2014 to 2019 using satellite technology and geological maps, among other devices. It was able to film the bodies of six people not yet identified floating in the water at the bottom of the 50-meter, that's about 150-foot deep pit, but there are clear indications that the number of corpses there is much higher. Speaking to France 24, Nadim Houri, a co-author of the report, a former director of Human Rights Watch's terrorism counterterrorism program, and now executive director of the Arab Reform Initiative think tank, looked back on the investigation and the questions it raised. So, what led you to investigate the Al-Huta pit? So he responds, it all started with a video that was leaked from the Islamic State group and broadcast by Syria media in June of 2014. The footage showed seven masked terrorists hurling the bodies of two men down into the abyss. At the time, the Islamic State group controlled the region and we couldn't investigate, but I knew the area well. I had been there in 2013, and even then, I was hearing rumors about dead bodies thrown down the gorge. After that, we couldn't go there until the summer of 2017 when the Islamic State group was driven out in the Battle of Raqqa? Well, for starters, the pit, so the question then is, what were the difficulties in investigating? Well, for starters, he says, the pit is hard to get to. It's a kind of canyon. It's deserted. It's a long way from the nearest road. The paths leading to it were littered with mines and explosives, and the abysses itself is very steep, with a 50-meter drop. That's a 150-foot drop. There were other complications. The village of Suluk is just a five-minute drive away, but its inhabitants were afraid to answer questions. Even though the Islamic State losing ground, it still had sleeper cells and members who refused to surrender. So how did the technology help your investigation? He says, our goal was to film at the bottom of the abyss, and drones were the best way to do that. But we had a lot of trouble getting the drones there. The Islamic State group was also using them, so the authorities in Iraqi Kurdistan, which he passed through, took almost a year to give us the green light to use them, lest our drones be hijacked by terrorists. Well, in September of 2018, we were finally able to bring two French technological devices that work without GPS. And this was necessary because firms had been ordered to cut their signals to aid the fight against the Islamic State group. And this technology allowed us to see down 150 feet into the abyss. It was an immense challenge. We almost lost a drone that was hit by a flock of birds down in the gorge, but a second drone finally gave us the footage we needed. So what did you discover down there? The images show six bodies floating on the surface of viscous water, probably pockets of oil, but we couldn't identify the bodies, nor could we dive under the surface where there are surely other corpses. Well, the Islamic State group was no longer in control of the area by this point in 2018. What made you think it was responsible? The abyss was probably used as a mass grave by rebel groups both before and after the Islamic State group controlled the area. In 2018, we informed the Syrian Democratic Forces, a rebel group that had taken control of the region, and they told us about the settling of scores between locals, but we have never been able to substantiate these claims. On the other hand, we do have evidence against the Islamic State group. Finally, there was the aforementioned video from 2014, and there are local testimonies and local journalistic investigations. We also knew that the Islamic State group did the same thing in another abyss in Iraq. Punishment for impure people who, according to their jihadist ideology, don't deserve to be buried, but understanding this practice would require further anthropological investigation. So why release the report now, they ask? Well, we pushed our technology to the maximum of what we could do. Now we've got to continue the investigation because so far what we've discovered raises more questions than answers. We begged the International Coalition Fighting the Islamic State group, then with the SDF, and now with Turkish troops in control of the area to ensure that the site is secured as a crime scene. Of course, the answers are not there, and it's imperative that we find them in order to write a complete history of the Islamic State group and to ensure that these crimes don't happen again. The report is just part of a bigger Human Rights Watch investigation and the disappearance caused by the Islamic State group. This abyss has a sensationalist aspect. It's intriguing. It already had a particular fascination for local people. Legend had it that there was a mythical creature there that kidnapped people, but it's now mass grave among numerous others. There are at least 20 in the region, and thousands of people have disappeared during the Islamic State group's reign, Westerners as well as Syrians and Iraqis. So the Syrians were the first to have suffered from the Islamic State group's atrocities. They've lost loved ones. They've seen their economy collapse, and giving answers from the fate of missing people would be a way of putting things back in order and helping the country to rebuild. It would allow families to mourn and the country to turn a page in its history. So very, very compelling sort of stuff. Well, I see it's 10:30. Let's give us a quick break and find out what's going on in our neck of the woods, and we'll be right back.
the Yonkers Tribune, named Home of the Acid-Tongued Bloggers by the New York Times, is a multifaceted news organization dedicated to keeping the citizens of Yonkers and Westchester informed via the internet and radio. Hezzy Aris is the tireless publisher, editor, and radio host of the Yonkers Tribune. He is a balding, bearded gnome, equipped with a digital camera and a steno pad at all times. Hezzy is frequently spotted in local meetings, translating the events into a Baroque prose style with an infusion of well-mannered outrage. The Yonkers Tribune attracts an informed, well-educated, affluent audience who hungers to know more about politics in all its permutations and nuances. Politics, says Hezzy, is our forte. Advertising inquiries are always welcome. Please call Hezzy Aris at 914-562-0834 or send an email to ehezi@hush.com.
Welcome back. In case you're interested in reaching out to the Yonkers Tribune, and we hope you would be, they've got one new number which incorporates every modality to reach them. So that number is 347-415-4326. 347-415-4326. And that number is good for their office, for their cell, for their text, and for leaving a voicemail message. So again, 347-415-4326 for text messaging, voicemail, and for the office as well as the cell phone. So all in one way. So let me just quickly look and just see. Okay, and then I want you to look at one other thing before we continue with more news, and that is to find, we have a message, more like a commercial for from the Westchester County District Attorney's Office. Bear with me a moment. Yeah, here it is. So District Attorney Tony Scarpino wants you to know that during this time of uncertainty, with so many of us at home and many businesses closed, that the criminal justice system is open and remains active to serve you. As always, call 911 to report all crimes. In addition, if you or someone you know has been the victim of domestic violence, child abuse, or elder abuse, call District Attorney Scarpino's Special Prosecutions Office at 914-995-3000. Again, the District Attorney's Special Prosecutions Office is reachable at 914 area code 995-3000. District Attorney Scarpino wants you to know that despite the coronavirus, the criminal justice system will always be here for you, and he urges you to stay at home and stay safe. So that is the message, and hope people take it seriously. Now, let's look at what else is going on here. It seems that the World Health Organization is stressing the need to find the source of coronavirus. Pinning down the source of the coronavirus pandemic should help in working out how COVID-19 has, quote, invaded the human species, end quote, so quickly, a senior World Health Organization official told Agence France-Presse. Well, the outbreak has triggered a fierce diplomatic spat between China and the United States, with the World Health Organization at the center of the row. In late March, U.S. President Donald Trump and his Chinese counterpart Xi Jinping struck an informal truce in the war of words over the origin of the deadly disease. But it quickly broke down. Trump has been accusing Beijing of being slow to alert the world to the initial outbreak in Wuhan, and openly suspects China of covering up an accident in the eastern city's virology lab. Far from the cross-Pacific spat, Sylvie Briand, the World Health Organization's Director of Infectious Hazard and Management, said it was crucial to know the origin of the virus to, quote, understand how it was or how it has evolved, end quote. It is a virus of animal origin transmitted to humans, and so we have to try to understand how the adaption of this virus allowed it to invade the human species, she told Agence France-Presse outside the World Health Organization's headquarters in Geneva. Well, the first case of SARS-CoV-2, the virus that caused the causes of the COVID-19 disease were reported in late December in Wuhan. Since then, the pandemic has infected more than 4 million people worldwide, claimed nearly 300,000 lives. And many researchers believe the new coronavirus came from bats but passed through another species before being transmitted to humans. The virus multiplied in these animals, changed a little in doing so, and finally resulted in a type of virus that is transmissible to human beings, said Briand, who in 2009 headed the World Health Organization's influenza program during the 2009 H1N1 swine flu pandemic. Retracing the origin of the virus by discovering the intermediate hosts would, quote, prevent the phenomenon from happening again and avoid ping-pong transmission between humans and animals. Every time it jumps from one species to another, the virus can mutate a bit, the French scientist said. That can have an impact on treatments. It can become resistant, while vaccines may no longer be effective enough. For now, there are still many unknown, despite thousands and thousands of samples having been taken, notably from many animals in the market in Wuhan, but also from dogs in Hong Kong, said Briand, stressing that the analysis will take time. The samples are taken by the World Health Organization member states, but the United Nations Health Agency encourages them to share information with each other in order to speed up research. Now, the United States and Australia have called for an international probe into the origin of the virus. More diplomatically, the World Health Organization has called on Beijing to invite them in to investigate the source. Shortly afterwards, in early May, China proposed setting up a commission under the auspices of the World Health Organization to assess the global response to COVID-19 and only once the pandemic is over. Well, the Chinese authorities insist that the plan should be signed off in advance of the World Health Organization's World Health Assembly or its executive board, the two main bodies of the United Nations agency, which host their annual meetings next week. Briand said the gatherings should also focus on the need to, quote, refine, end quote, the World Health Organization's health alert system, which only allows the organization to declare whether there is a global emergency or not, while the previous procedure had six stages, with the last being declared a pandemic. Quote, we need to find a system that can trigger alerts so that people can get ready, she said. But at the same time, we have to tell them whether it is imminent or it is coming in a few weeks or months and tell them more precisely what it is they need to be prepared for.
Okay.
Now, let's see what else is going on. This is very discouraging. In the United Kingdom, is supposedly in a significant recession. As the economy shrinks by a record 5.8% in March alone, Britain's economy shrank by a record 5.8% in March as the COVID-19 crisis escalated and the government shut down much of the country, according to official data that point towards an even bigger hit to come. The monthly drop in gross domestic product was felt in almost all sectors, from the country's shuttered restaurants and bars to its building sites and factories, and was the largest since comparable records began in 1997. The sharp contraction in the United Kingdom's fiscal quarter of gross domestic product comes as little surprise, but does clearly highlight the magnitude of the challenge facing policymakers, J.P. Morgan market strategist Hugh Gimber had said. In the first 3 months of the year, gross domestic product contracted by 2% from the last 3 months of 2019, the biggest drop since the depth of the financial crisis in late 2008, the Office for National Statistics had said. Well, the Bank of England said last week that the contraction of the economy in the April to June period could approach 25%, and lead to the largest annual decline in more than three centuries. British two-year government bond yields sank to a record low of minus 0.045% after the data, reinforcing expectations that the Bank of England will ramp up its record 732 billion euros, I guess it's about $900 billion of asset purchases next month. Finance Minister Rishi Sunak said Britain was now in the midst of a significant recession. Quote, we have to support people's jobs, their incomes, livelihoods at this time, and support businesses so we can get through the period of severe disruption and emerge stronger on the other side, she said, after the gross gross domestic product data. Okay, so on Tuesday, Britain's government extended a costly job support program for another 4 months, though businesses will need to pick up more of the tab from August onward. The decline in first quarter gross domestic product was slightly smaller than economists had forecast in a Reuters poll, and less than the 3.8% slump suffered by the Eurozone in the first quarter. The worst hit country in Europe, with more than 40,000 deaths from coronavirus, according to official data, Britain has been in extensive lockdown since March 23, a later date than in many other European countries. England tentatively began easing its COVID-19 lockdown on Wednesday, with some people who cannot do their jobs at home urged to return to work, while Scotland, Wales, and Northern Ireland, which have semi-autonomous governments, are sticking with a stay-at-home message for now. United Kingdom Prime Minister Boris Johnson's government has faced a barrage of criticism that its new guidance, stay alert, control the virus, save lives, was confusing. Appearing on Sky News television, Transport Minister Grant Shapps was asked why estate agents were being allowed to restart house viewing when people could not have their own relatives visit. Well, the truth of the matter is you have to start somewhere, and the lockdown message was very straightforward. It was just stay at home. And now as we start to unlock, the course here or there was to have the decisions made. And that's what Shapp said. So there's no perfect way of doing this. And we'd ask people to use their common sense. Right now, there has to be a cutoff somewhere. Now, workers were being advised to avoid public transport if at all possible, and schools remained closed, prompting questions about how parents and people who could not get to work by other means were supposed to apply the new guidance. Well, employers faced the daunting task of creating a safe environment for their staff, with detailed guidance on one-way systems at entry and exit points and in stairwells, spacing out workstations and other minutiae. For those still working from home or unable to work, there was only a very slight change in the regime. People were now allowed out to exercise more than once a day, and two people from separate households were allowed to meet outdoors as long as they kept 2 meters apart. That's 6 feet apart. Martin Hewitt, a chairman of the National Police Chiefs Council, said officers would still be encouraging people to go home if they were out for reasons other than the authorized exercise, shopping for essentials, health, or work. Everyone will carry on, hopefully working in the spirit we've had for the latest 7 weeks, he told BBC television. It's not for the police to police people being 2 meters apart, 6 feet apart. That's about everyone's individual responsibility. If there are those people who refuse to abide by the new regulations, then we will move direct enforcement if that's what we have to do, he said, describing that as a last resort. Okay, so such complexity, let's face it, so it's going to be very, very fascinating. Now, let's see what's going on. Oh, I forgot to tell you about this. Yeah, we should do this first. It seems that at odds with the Trump administration, the U.S. virus expert Fauci has warned of the risks of reopening too soon. Well, the U.S. government's top infection disease expert warned Congress yesterday that ending lockdowns too soon could trigger fresh and uncontrollable outbreaks of coronavirus 19. In his first appearance on Capitol Hill in 2 months, Anthony Fauci delivered a cautionary message at odds with the rhetoric of President Donald Trump, who has pressed for rapid steps to rekindle the devastated. The respected scientist told a Senate panel that federal authorities had developed guidelines on how to safely reopen activities, with a sustained 14-day decrease in cases as a vital first step. If a community or state or region doesn't go by these guidelines or those guidelines and reopens, the consequences could only be really serious, he said. There is a real risk that you will trigger an outbreak that you may not be able to control, he added later, warning that that would not only cost lives, but could even set you back on the road to trying to get economic recovery. Responding to a question from Senator Bernie Sanders, Fauci acknowledged that the United States coronavirus deaths are likely higher than the official death toll of roughly 80,000. This, he said, was because many people, particularly in the hardest hit New York, died at home before they could be admitted to a hospital. And some colleges, meanwhile, have begun announcing plans to restart classes in fall. But Fauci argued it was a bridge too far to expect vaccines or treatments might be ready in time to assuage student fears. The antiviral remdesivir was recently shown in a clinical trial to speed up the recovery time for COVID-19 patients, but Fauci said the results were modest, quote unquote, and concerned hospitalized patients. He added that the treatment closest to wide use by the fall might be a blood plasma from recovered patients. Now, Fauci said he was cautiously optimistic about the prospects of a vaccine with 8 candidates undergoing clinical trials, including one made by the firm Moderna, which is closely collaborating with the National Institutes of Health, where he is a senior official. Its efficacy could be determined by late fall or early winter, he said. We have many candidates and hope to have multiple winners, Fauci added. In other words, it's multiple shots on goal. Well, Fauci, who has become the trusted face of the federal government's virus response, was one of the 4 top medical experts testifying remotely to the Senate Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee. The director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, Fauci, was in modified quarantine after Vice President Mike Pence's spokeswoman, with whom he had no close contact, tested positive. A statement issued later by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC, said that Fauci, the CDC Director Robert Redfield, and Food and Drug Administration FDA Commissioner Stephen Hahn could return to work if they check their temperatures and wear masks. There has been frequent speculation that Fauci's forthright approach has irked Trump, who has been accused of downplaying the risk as he pushes to restart the economy. Fauci appeared in Congress hours after Trump renewed that message on Twitter, writing, quote, numbers are coming down in most parts of our country, which wants to open and get going again. It is happening safely. The United States has reported more than 80,000 deaths and 1.3 million infections. And while the situation has improved in New York and the daily nationwide death toll has dipped markedly in recent days, the rate of new cases has yet to drop off dramatically. Though widely respected by lawmakers in both major parties, Fauci came under fire from Republican Paul Rand, who said that because the mortality rate in children is low, schools should be reopened faster than certain districts. As much as I respect you, Dr. Fauci, I don't think you're the end-all, said Paul. I think you're the one person who gets to make that decision. Fauci responded that he only offered scientific advice, but warned not to be cavalier in thinking that children are completely immune to the deleterious effects of COVID-19, given growing reports of children suffering from a related autoimmune syndrome. Well, the White House has outlined a three-phase approach to help state and local officials reopen their economies while observing medical advice on lifting the virus spread, as well as a two-week downward trajectory of cases. It calls for robust testing for at-risk healthcare workers with asymptomatic cases screened as well, and contacts of positive cases traced. Very, very compelling sort of stuff. So, and just very, very pertinent. So let's see, we've got only about 9 minutes left before our central guest. So one second, wanted to just check to see what else has transpired. And this is interesting because in Israel, students are returning to school as Israel is emerging from the COVID-19 lockdown. So let's see how this is looking over there. It turns out that it's been almost 2 months since children at a Jerusalem school played together. In the morning they came and they were so high they didn't know what to do, where to play first, said a teacher. Well, 3 days a week, a Jerusalem school welcomes half of one class. They use the green toys. On the other days, it is the second half who use the blue toys, but only after parents complete a form each day recording their child's temperature. Returning to school is not yet compulsory in Israel. We told parents from the beginning, if you don't want to bring them back until the beginning of next year, it's okay. We understand, said a school staff member. Well, so that's the situation there, and we'll have to see how that all bears out over time. And so very, very compelling. Bear with me a moment here because I wanted to cover some other issues that I may have overlooked before. And one second here. All right. Okay. All right. I want to look at one other thing here. Bear with me a moment. Okay. 1 second. All right, let me see where we are here. Okay, I think this is where I have to be. One second. Yeah, this might be telling, but not exactly sure how that will affect us, though, at the end of the day. Evidently, the French easing after a two-month lockdown, but it did knock off 6% off the gross domestic product. France's economic downturn is easing as the country emerges from a lockdown imposed in mid-March, although activity remains mired at levels far below normal, the central bank said yesterday. The Eurozone's second biggest economy was operating 27% below normal levels in April after 32% in the second half of March, the Bank of France said, basing its estimates on responses from its monthly business climate survey. The ambition we could have for the next, for the end of May, is to recover another 10 points. Bank of France Governor François Villeroy de Galois said on France Interradio. Now, France began unwinding its strict lockdown on Monday, allowing non-essential stores, shops and factories and other businesses to reopen for the first time in 8 months. Central Bank said that manufacturing activity remained down 37% last month, but was nonetheless better than the 48% seen in March, while private sector service to firms activity was reduced by 27% in April after 37% in March. Bank of France did not venture to make a quarterly gross domestic product forecast. It usually does when it publishes its business climate survey, given the unprecedented nature of the current downturn. However, Villeroy said that the 2 months of lockdown cost the economy 6% in lost activity this year so far, although the final bill would probably be higher as the recovery would be uneven. So, very, very compelling sort of stuff, to say the least. Now, quickly, let me just quickly look to see if we've got anything else here which you might find interesting. This is on a lighter side. It turns out that Tom Cruise is going to be the first actor to film in outer space. Can you believe this? Well, film critic Lisa Nesselson, she spoke to someone from NASA, the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, a woman by the name of Eve Jackson, about NASA's plans to make Tom Cruise the first actor to shoot a film in outer space. So, my God, they also that was a central point. So, evidently, we're going into space with film. So that's probably going to be a blockbuster. Just the whole concept of it is going to be very, very interesting. So we'll have to see where that goes. Okay, now let me quickly go back here to our studio screen. Bear with me a moment here. And 1 second. Okay, we should be able to return here. Okay, we seem to be fine there. What I want to do is... you know what? Let me play a quick commercial for you, and then we'll be right back.
Hey, you a judge?
Well, sorta. I report on cheese. I don't judge.
Well, I heard on the radio Cabot Cheddar always wins awards for taste.
Well, let me see my notes. Best taste? Check. Best texture? Check. The farm families in Cabot, Vermont have won every major award in the cheese world.
Every award?
Every.
What about the U.S. Cheese Championships?
Cabot's won that many times.
How about the American Cheese Society Contest?
Cabot won it.
World Cheese Championship Award?
Best in class on cheddar.
Fiery Food Challenge?
Cabot.
International Fancy Food Show?
Cabot rules.
The Stanley Cup?
That's hockey.
Oh.
Look, Cabot's won awards for best sharp, best light, best butter, and best cheddar.
Yeah, but a certain big cheese company's TV ad show, they won an award from judges wearing bright yellow lab coats.
Oh, those are actors.
Not real judges?
Real judges wear white lab coats.
They do?
Look, Cabot is best because they own the company, ship the milk, make the cheese. They won so many times, the real judges even asked one of Cabot's cheesemakers to be a judge.
I don't believe you.
Here, taste.
Hey, I can taste why Cabot's won every award.
You be the judge.
And I get to wear a yellow lab coat.
White lab coat. Check.
The best tasting cheddar on the planet is...
Time and time again.
Cabot Cheddar.
Check.
Well, our next guest is going to be shortly calling us. His name is Brian Hoadley. He is the chief revenue officer for a company called Power Breezers. And what done... is they immerse themselves into technology that has begotten a remedy necessary for our times. They have the ability to disinfect like large facilities to protect people that are in those facilities from the coronavirus. And specifically, they began their efforts in prisons and correction facilities across the country. And they've gotten some phenomenally, really excellent press from those prisons. And their intent was to ensure the safety of the inmates, the correction officers, other staff as well. And a recent study conducted by the Bureau of Prisons showed that over 70% of inmates tested have the COVID-19 coronavirus. So let's face it, when we look at a prison system, it's nearly impossible to achieve social distancing in prisons and jails. And as a result, many correctional facilities are requiring their staff and inmates to wear face masks and take additional measures to provide the necessary safety and protection from the COVID-19 virus. Now, prisons across the country have begun using power breather machines to spray Environmental Protection Agency approved disinfectants throughout the facilities. So we're going to find out the story of this company, and we're going to be able to just find out once and for all what Brian Hoadley has to say about this. And this is very, very, oh, he's already on the line. So good morning, Mr. Hoadley. How are you, sir?
Good morning, Hezzy. Thank you for having me on today. I'm doing great.
What
about yourself?
I am. You know, I'm sequestered. I'm doing my thing. So I'm very lucky because I'm kept so busy. I can't freak out by the walls in the apartment. So I hope you're doing likewise.
I am. I'm sheltering in place, working from home like everybody, and moving from one meeting to the next. Either it's a Zoom call or a telephone call as quick as you switch a button, right?
Absolutely. And it's really an encouraging mode because I think we just miss that connection of actually being with people and seeing people and that sort of stuff. But one thing that's really interesting about your company is that it's unique, and I had not heard of a large-scale operation like yours. And it's interesting that you began in the prison system. So tell us a little bit about the firm. How did Power Breeze get into meeting the demands of a prison because in the prison so many people were infected with COVID-19 virus? And how did you even learn about it? Or did they contact you? Did you contact them? This is a very compelling story.
Yeah, thank you. So we originally started in about 10 years ago working with the military and to devise a solution to help cool our officers and our military personnel as they're deployed into Iran, Iraq, Afghanistan, where it's very hot.
Yes.
And they're working in those hot environments. And so originally the design was a mobile unit that could be deployed for the military. And what makes it interesting is there's a 80-gallon tank of water, and about mid-March or so, one of our customers, one of our Fortune 100 customers, came to us and said, could we put EPA-approved disinfectants, water-soluble disinfectants, in your tank and use your misting technology to disperse those EPA disinfectants per the CDC's guidelines and disinfect for coronavirus? And we assembled our technologists. Yeah, we assembled our technologists and said, this might be a very viable option to help society and pivot what was originally intended as a cooling solution to help combat this pandemic that the world is facing. And so we did. In a very short period of time, our entire company rallied around helping society and solve this problem.
That is very compelling. It looks like that we already have a call, so maybe that call's for you because I'm sure they're not calling me. Good morning, caller. Do you have a question or a statement to make? Oh, evidently they hung up for some crazy reason. Or maybe we lost them on the line. That was not intentional. So this was brilliant. And how long did it take for you to move from what you were originally doing and repurposing your efforts? And so how did that come about?
Yeah, so we after we did our study, it took about a week to really analyze, could we do this? Would it be effective? We have some brilliant technologists in Israel, and they worked very hard and determined that this was a viable solution. We're strictly following the CDC and EPA guidelines. And so we're dispersing the disinfectants that the EPA recommends. And then we went out. There's over 30,000 units already deployed around the globe, a lot with the military, a lot in the corrections facilities already today. And we wanted to give our customers a purpose right away that they could get these units out and use them You know, we couldn't ramp manufacturing that quickly to meet the demand. But with the units already installed in the field, we could deploy the redeploy those immediately. And so it took us about 2 weeks, and we got the word out to all the customers, and we did a multiple campaigns to let them know right away that this was an option for them.
That's truly fascinating. It was interesting. You've already got notice in North Carolina for at the North Carolina Institution for Women in Raleigh. And evidently, it was very effective of these fans, these vaporizing fans, to disinfect large portions of the facility. And how often does that process need to be taken? Is that a daily routine? How long does the whole operation take?
So it depends on what you're doing and how you're doing it. In the prison systems themselves, they're using it in the common areas, the dorms, the break rooms, the cafeterias. And depending on the size of the room, it's anywhere from 10 minutes to an hour of spraying the disinfectant. The CDC recommends that a thin film is placed on every surface for about 10 minutes to kill the coronavirus. And then you open up the room and let it ventilate. You can accelerate the ventilation with the power breezer and fan only mode. And so it can take anywhere from a half an hour to an hour and a half to completely ventilate a room. And you do it with nobody inside the room. So you start the breezer, you leave the room, you let the machine do its work. And then you come back and ventilate the room, and it's a pretty seamless process. So a lot of people, we have it in commercial buildings right now. We have it in all the prisons, as you mentioned. We have 7 states across the country using it that we're aware of anyway, using it for disinfecting. We have about 31 different facilities across the U.S. And in North Carolina itself, there's, I think, 15. We have some in Connecticut, in Texas, and other states, Utah, Alabama, South Carolina as well. And so it's widely accepted there. We also have it in commercial facilities. So we have a lot of logistics operations using them for the same thing, for the common areas, break rooms, heavy traffic areas. And it's the same process followed everywhere. We have a white paper on our website about how to do it and how to implement it.
Very, very fascinating. How large are these machines? Are you able to literally move them from one room to another?
Yeah, they're on very large wheels. It's like probably like a large washing machine, kind of to give the users, the listeners a feel for the size. A large washing machine on 4 large wheels. And it's got an 85-gallon tank of water. So, you know, when fully loaded, it could be heavy, but the balance of the machine makes it actually move pretty easily around. So you can move it from one room to the next room. We also have applications where we're in schools and correctional facilities also disinfecting buses. So you put it on a forklift, you go into the window of the bus, ventilate the bus, and then or disinfect the bus, I'm sorry, and then let it ventilate. And those are very quick because obviously the size of a bus is pretty small. So in just a few minutes, you can sanitize the entire bus. Other things like transportation, like rail systems, subways, commuter trains and things like that are also being investigated right now.
That's truly amazing because you're the only ones that I've heard of. There are all sorts of other concepts, but you're using approved items that are recognized to be effective. And so you're able to disinfect large facilities. And it's huge because it can reopen our economy, like schools, for example. You know, parents can actually go to work or even just telecommute if they knew they had the security of knowing that when their child went to school, they would be safe there. And the teachers would be willing to go to work there as well if they felt secure that it was safe and disinfected.
And then I have a really –
go ahead. I'm sorry. Well,
oh, I was just
going to
say,
ahead.
I have
I'm
a really
fine.
Good friend. Yeah, I have a really, really good friend. His wife is a school teacher here locally where I live in near San Francisco. And he was saying that even come fall when school resumes, the teachers are really, really concerned how they're going to resume classes. And this
right.
is an option. You know, this right now what most people are doing is either they're not doing anything or they're sanitizing by hand. And it's very labor-intensive, time-consuming, questionable if it's effective. I was just reading an article about that last night. What we offer is an opportunity at a very affordable cost, low cost for that matter, compared to other options, to be able to disinfect everything and to know everything has been sanitized in a very short period of time. And so, you know, on a nightly basis, you could know that the facility has been sanitized and you can come back assured that there's no virus in the room or space.
Well, it's so interesting because I was just thinking of that myself. I live in New York, the New York metropolitan
mm-hmm.
area, and we have the train system. I don't even remember how old it is, but it has never – it's been functioning 24 hours a day from the very beginning, except now it's being stopped from I think it's 1 o'clock or it's 12 o'clock midnight or 1 o'clock in the morning till – 5 or 6 o'clock in the morning every day in order to clean everything down. But it can't be as easy as being able to spray the interior and I guess it would be to the open air as well. It, as long as you keep the doors open after you've sprayed everything down, it could probably dry up very quickly. So we wouldn't
yeah.
necessarily have to keep it closed down for so many hours every day. And our buses, the buses are, I don't know if they're being cleaned every day, if you really must know. I know that we now don't permit people to enter a bus in the New York metropolitan area at the front of the bus where you would pay your fee, and they only allow you to enter in the back in order to keep the bus driver 6 feet distant from with a partition from those that come on board. So that's to
right.
protect the bus driver. And at the same time, you know, they're hoping that people can avoid using transportation altogether. But
right.
that's the modality. But then if you would be able to disinfect a bus, for example, completely, that would be a revenue stream back again, because right now nobody's paying for bus service. And it'd be phenomenal if you can open up the trains in a much faster way. And the efficacy of opening up a school is mind-boggling. And what about city councils and offices of government so that people can actually go there and see the city clerk or stuff like that, or government offices
right.
like court.
Yeah, well, and going back to your comment on the New York subway and the bus system, I think that right now there's not a lot of solutions out there. And so what
no.
you see is that the New York, I think it's the MTA, right, that's doing
yes,
all the work
the
there. It's the only option they know of is to do it by hand. And so there's a massive amount of labor. I saw a picture of one area where there were probably 25 or 30 people by hand wiping down surfaces.
Yeah.
Who knows if they got all the surfaces? Did they meet the CDC and EPA guidelines of letting the disinfectant sit long enough? Whereas
mm-hmm.
other solutions like this were typically used in hospitals only, right? The
right.
disinfecting fogging machines were only available for hospitals, which is where we want them. But now we've got an industrial-grade solution that could be used. And so what we hope is that the word gets out that this can be used in lots of applications, like we were just talking, you know, the schools, buses, transportation systems, warehouses. You were just talking about offices. Yes, we believe the lobbies, especially because that's where most of the people congregate,
right.
should be sanitized in a bigger way. And we're talking to several commercial real estate developers about coming in a mass for them as they come back to work. This is going to be the new normal, right? This is kind kind of what
Absolutely.
We felt after 9/11. Yeah, after 9/11, we all got used to a new normal of security. Unfortunately, we're going to have a new normal coming back out of this of sanitization.
Well, also, you might be able to actually get involved in opening up airports as well. If you can sanitize the airplanes, there might be just the capacity to do all of those things. So it looks like you have a modality that works. It's effective. It's not just a trial effort.
Right.
Can disinfect so many different things. And also, we have a major problem with senior citizen homes where a lot
yes.
of people get infected, and it's almost like a petri dish because everyone's so close to the people who help them, as well as the communal eating situation there, or people exercising in one major gym where everybody's breathing next to one another, I guess.
Right.
All those things could be cleaned up. Now,
right.
the machine seems to be small enough to function almost everywhere. How expensive is it to disinfect a school? I guess it all depends on the size. But is it very expensive?
Well, I'll answer that question first, but I wanted to come back to your point about the transportation and airplanes. Originally, this system was designed for cooling, right? And it's a dual-purpose solution now, so cooling the people that work in hot environments. And in the transportation
right.
space and airplanes, we actually have units deployed for most of the major airlines today for cooling those people
cool.
working in the runways and the maintenance areas and in the baggage handling and things like that. And so very quickly, the airlines could do a study and see if this is effective for disinfecting internally inside the airplane, because they already have the units. They could simply repurpose them. And so there's
wow.
lots of – and the second thing you mentioned on convalescent homes, we're actually in discussions with a person that's experienced in the convalescent home industry about helping us to get the word out in that industry, because we agree with you 100% that that's another great application to help our elderly, and they're in homes and they don't have a lot of area to get away from, and they're kind of shelter in place there permanently, right? And so if we could help
right.
that would be tremendous. So those
Absolutely.
Are two big
you know,
areas
I,
we're looking
and-
at.
Like when I ask you about price, I'm not asking you for an exact figure or even a roundabout, because I guess what we have to do is balance out the cost of keeping people safe from being infected or reinfected
right.
and at the same time being able to function and therefore get people to go back to work. So if
yeah.
you can open up a restaurant and yet you know that you can disinfect it every night, then that can give people an interest to say, okay, fine, I'll go. Otherwise,
right, exactly.
the place is going to be shut down all the time. So there's got to be a balance here, but it seems
right.
you have the balance.
Yeah, and so it's interesting. One of the commercial property managers I was talking to just this week, he mentioned that he's getting quotes from companies to come in and do hand sanitization of about 40 cents a square foot. So you can imagine a 2,000 or 5,000 square foot facility. You know, you can figure out the price there for every night you're going to be paying. What does that work out to? My math isn't very good, but let's say it's 5,000 square feet. So you're
okay.
looking at around a couple thousand dollars a day to do that work.
A day.
Right?
Okay.
A day. So if you're doing a 5,000 square foot facility every day, you're doing it for 30 days, you're going to spend $50,000 to $60,000 a month to sanitize your facility.
Right.
Which is pretty pricey. Our machine, depending on where you buy it through distribution, you can actually see them on Amazon today. On Amazon, I think they're $6,000. But if you buy them through distribution, and we're in throughout most of the major distributors in the U.S., they're around $5,000 and
okay.
and very little labor to run them. So It's an order of magnitude less expensive than doing it by hand. Now, if you multiply larger areas, you've got a lot more labor. The cost of that labor goes up dramatically. So we're significantly less expensive and more effective and more efficient than the other options out there from when it's done manually.
Well, also the way I'm thinking as well is, for every individual that comes down with a coronavirus, besides the anxiety level, not being able to work, and possibly not seeing your parents if they're of a certain age.
Right.
And, you know, just the whole dynamic of it all, even though it sounds like a lot of money, it's probably cheaper to run a cleaning operation in one big facility, cheaper than even taking care of one individual at a hospital.
Oh, yeah, for sure. And it's, you know, what's the price of knowing the comfort and, like you said, anxiety and fear and comfort of knowing that your facility is clean of any viruses.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's invaluable right there. You couldn't put a price on that.
Absolutely.
And the other interesting thing is we're working with a couple of there's multiple EPA approved, and there's, I think, a couple thousand EPA approved disinfectants that kill the coronavirus. There are several of them that are in trials right now, where you only have to disperse it once a week, and it continues to stay on the surface and disinfect for that long. And they're not fully approved yet, and they're in process. But yeah, we're talking to several different companies about applications that may not need to be every night, may need to be less frequently.
That might even reduce the cost overall over time.
Exactly. Exactly.
There's
a number of different products being, and every day we're hearing of new products, and we wait for the EPA to approve those products. We're not in the disinfecting approval process mostly, and
right.
But we keep appraised of everything that's out
right.
there.
Right. So that means if conceivably these things, if they're already working on it and they see some sort of efficacy or leading towards efficacy only once a week, that means if you've got a school system of, I don't know, just even seven schools, you can cover them all if you can disinfect them once a week. And you've got seven schools. That's huge. That means you could actually move the equipment from place to place.
Yeah, and with the funding that's out there through, you know, the CARES Act and FEMA and other government programs, a lot of these school systems can be getting funding, and the prison systems, for that matter, can be getting funding to help offset the cost of this equipment in a very short order. And I'm not exactly sure what different prison systems have done, but I believe that some of them have taken advantage of the CARES Act and the FEMA funding that's out there to acquire this product, our Power Breezers.
So your firm, Power Breeze, you must be growing exponentially. I mean, you know, you've got to keep your customers at bay. I mean, how do you do this? I mean, have you to employ 1,000-fold the number of people in your staff?
That's awesome. I love that. We're still a small company, but we are. Our peak season was June through August, when the hottest time of the year and everybody wants those. We saw our peak shift from, we internally say our peak went from July to April. And so we've been running at peak capacity for the last 2 months, and we'll see that continue now. And we'll continue to ramp. We're air shipping everything in from China and other areas. We've got stuff being manufactured in Georgia and in South Carolina, and then all the assembly is done in Charlotte. And so we're air shipping everything so we can meet the demand that's been accelerated with this dual purpose solution. And we can, also, you know, as we hit May, we're starting to hit the heat. And so during the day, use it for cooling your workers in those hot environments. And, you know, especially the logistics facilities that where workers are unloading trailers and containers, the demand on online shipping for all of us, everybody has my UPS and FedEx and Amazon trucks pull up a couple times a day, like everybody else in across America now. And those workers are working in very hot environments. So during the day, you use the power breezers to cool your people. And then at night, disinfect the facility so that it's ready to go in the next day.
Truly amazing. So you did mention, so you get equipment that's manufactured abroad and then it's assembled here in the United States. So you're also employing people here in the United States. And what was the connection with Israel? Is that the chemical compound?
No. We don't do anything with the chemicals themselves. We Israel is where our CTO and our engineering team is. The technology was originally designed there, but our CTO is there, and he's working on our next generation breezer. So our power breezer today, we call it our Mach 4, and the team in Israel is working on our next generation. We're also coming out with a cooling solution that would be used for like the warehouse logistics space that's mounted to the facility. So this, the current version is mobile. In the future, it's going to be mounted, especially as we all continue to consume online shopping. Those workers need to be cool, and so we want to get the cooling technology up off the ground and out of the way, but also to cool them. So we're working on those technologies. Nothing to do with chemicals in Israel. And we do manufacture subcomponents in the U.S. We do a bunch of probably half of the subcomponents are manufactured in the U.S. and then half overseas. And so we're bringing everything in as fast as we can to meet the demand. It's wonderful.
That is truly exciting. So is this the first time you've worked for a corporation like this? It's a very compelling. My God, you must jump out of bed every morning. Do you ever get any sleep? I mean, it's so exciting what you're doing.
Yeah, it is. It's very exciting. And it's also very rewarding, both helping to combat COVID and to help cool people working in hot environments. It's a very strong passion. Our entire team is just unbelievably passionate about the purpose of the company. You know, we believe everyone deserves to be cool and to be safe. And that passion resonates throughout our entire culture. And so, yeah, people on our team, they work long days, but it's rewarding days. We're 7 to 7, 7 to 10 o'clock kind of a company right now. And it's a great reward.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, as we kind of
anything more exciting.
Yeah, and as we mentioned earlier, as the economy gets back to work, gets back to school, the power breezers are going to be used to help combat the COVID-19 and spray disinfectants in the facilities regularly. This is going to be our new normal. It's going to be a critical part of what we do going forward.
Mm-hmm. Truly amazing. And did you realize you would be a futurist, that your company would be moving into the future with a new modality that, as you say, it's going to be our normal?
No, I wish I could say we knew that happened. I mean, I was listening to, I don't know if you saw the news over the weekend, but they were talking about that there's researchers working constantly around the clock, around the globe, to try and ward off, right, the next pandemic and the next situation. And they're trying desperately to stay ahead of it. And, you know, if any of us knew when it was coming or how to do it, we'd all be billionaires with following the stock market and preempting it. So unfortunately, I did not know it was coming, but I am happy and excited to be a part of and working for a company and a team that's a part of helping to combat this global pandemic.
Very, very exciting. Mr. Hoadley, how do people reach out to you if they want to explore the efficacy for their particular project, whether it be a prison or whether it be a school or whether it be a government office or the court systems? This is like an endless application.
Yeah, it is. And thank you. If you go to www.powerbreezer.com, there's a link right at the top for COVID-19, and on there you can fill out just your name and email address, and we'll send you the white paper, and we'll follow up with you if you want to be followed up with and reached out to. And we have a team that's ready to help discuss the solution and how to do the application and how to implement it in your facility. And what we've done in the white paper, it talks about what we've done for testing and validation of the solution and things like that.
Very, very exciting. Any other last words from you, unfortunately, because we have to close?
No problem. Thank you so much.
I hope you'll
I really appreciate
coming back again.
Absolutely. I would love to. And thank you so much for inviting me today and for our discussion. And as I mentioned, as the economy gets back to work and back to school, this is going to be our new normal and going to be a critical part of our daily lives. And so how do we adapt, and what's the best solution for the different applications that needs to be considered for everybody?
Oh, I forgot. It was one thing. I saw that it was Power Breezers was the company name, but I saw, am I remembering correctly, it said 265 Power Breezer. Is that a particular unit?
No, so 265 is how many units the North Carolina Corrections Organization bought.
Oh.
So North Carolina prison system for, I think it's 15 facilities, bought 265 units to spread throughout each of them. So what's that, around 10 to 15 per facility, something like that, if my math is right. Maybe 15.
I guess. I'm not good at math.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. But it's powerbreezer.com is the website.
Okay. Yeah, I guess that's why you're the chief revenue officer, because you're good at the math. So
I don't know about that, but
that's
helpful.
I try.
Yeah.
Well, that's very, very compelling. I'm so pleased that you spent the time with us. I'm just so excited about the product and the efficacy of it. It's been proven. And I'm just in shock that so many places are unaware, and yet there's so many places that are. So that's very, very encouraging. I'm really shocked that in the New York metropolitan area, we just have no clue. I don't know what's going on here, because when I look at the way they're cleaning the subway system, I'm saying, you're 100% right. I can't imagine that when you have people cleaning the metal in the subway and the top parts of the subway car itself, that you could be touching everything and making sure that it's all clean. And so the mist makes all the sense in the world.
Yep. And you know, for us all of us in across the U.S., this has really been in the last 2 months. So the pivot, everybody's learning quickly, and originally the focus and emphasis, rightfully so, was on the health and safety of the people that were getting sick, and how do we make sure we have enough beds, and how do we make sure our facility, our healthcare facilities are in place and supportive. And that's where the energy should have gone. Now we need to pivot and educate people exactly what your show is doing. It's sharing solutions that are out there so that our government officials and our mayors and healthcare and the county healthcare facility officers are aware of other solutions that are out there. And now they can look at options and see what's best for them.
Absolutely. Well, I'm going to have to call up the mayor and the assemblyman and the congressman.
By.
Okay. Well, I'll give them your number. That's for sure.
Perfect.
Well, thank you again, sir.
Please
all
do.
The best. I appreciate what you're doing.
Thank you, Hezzy. I appreciate it as well. Great conversation. Thank you.
Be well, Mr. Hoadley.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
There we have it.
Bye.
Brian Hoadley. He's the chief revenue officer with PowerBreezer.com, and you might want to just look into it. Well, you'd be saving lives, evidently. And the best part of all is it's efficaciously been proven. PBA, well, it's not PBA, but I was thinking of the law enforcement, but approved by, you know, the chemicals have been approved, which is fantastic. All right, let's quickly find out what else is going on in our neck of the woods, and then we'll be right back.
Hey, you a judge?
Well, sorta. I report on cheese. I don't judge.
Well, I heard on the radio, Cabot Cheddar always wins awards for taste.
Well, let me see my notes. Best taste? Check. Best texture? Check. The farm families in Cabot, Vermont have won every major award in the cheese world.
Every award?
Every.
What about the U.S. Cheese Championships?
Cabot's won that many times.
How about the American Cheese Society Contest?
Cabot won it.
World Cheese Championship Award?
Best in class on cheddar.
Fiery Food Challenge?
Cabot.
International Fancy Food Show?
Cabot rules.
The Stanley Cup?
That's hockey.
Oh.
Look, Cabot's won awards for best sharp, best light, best butter, and best cheddar.
Yeah, but a certain big cheese company's TV ad show, they won an award from judges wearing bright yellow lab coats.
Well, those are actors.
Not real judges?
Real judges wear white lab coats.
They do.
Look, Cabot is best because they own the company, ship the milk, make the cheese. They won so many times, the real judges even asked one of Cabot's cheesemakers to be a judge.
I don't believe you.
Here, taste.
Hey, I can taste why Cabot's won every award.
You be the judge.
And I get to wear a yellow lab coat.
White lab coat. Check.
The best tasting cheddar on the planet is...
Time and time again.
Cabot Cheddar.
Check.
Well, thank you very much for hanging on there with us today. Unfortunately, I have a major appointment that needs to be kept. So we're going to shut down, but we're going to welcome you to consider joining us tomorrow. And the reason for that is because we've got some phenomenal, guests for tomorrow. As I think we do every Thursday. We're going to be speaking with Lori and John Wiles. They're engaged in doing a review of a Hyundai, which is very, very compelling. I will put the article up, the review itself up today, and we'll be able to discuss it tomorrow at 10 o'clock. And then from 10:30 to 11:30, we're going to speak to Gabrielle M. Etzel. She's the publisher and editor of the Unvarnished blog. Always exciting to talk to her. And we'll be able to learn a great deal about some of the issues that we began to talk about last week. But there were so many issues that were left uncovered or unresolved. I guess we didn't get to them. I think we're going to be able to move on in the same direction. So I'll check with her to see if she's got something else that may be more pertinent at our particular juncture for tomorrow. Very, very exciting to say the least. So I'm just so pleased with Mr. Hoadley. My God, I'm just like in shock. And you would have thought that everybody in New York, the metropolitan area, we would be cutting edge on the front lines in every way conceivable. But evidently, we're not. So evidently, there's something to be learned outside the metropolitan area. I'm not joking, and I'm not being facetious. Very, very exciting stuff. All right, got to get going. So all the best to you, and we hope you'll join us tomorrow. Goodbye.